It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we look at President Barack Obama's proposal to slash carbon emissions in a bid to curb global warming. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. President Obama has made addressing climate change a high priority for his administration. It is an area in which he can take executive measures without having to get approval from a reluctant Congress. The U.S. Supreme Court has said the U.S. president has the authority under the Clean Air Act. The Obama administration has unveiled a plan to cut carbon emissions from power plants in the United States by nearly one-third in the next 15 years. U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Gina McCarthy called the proposal ambitious but achievable. She says the key to making the plan work is that each of the 50 U.S. states will have its own goal tailored to its particular circumstances. The initiative aims to promote renewable energy sources such as solar and wind, as well as energy efficiency. The proposal, which is expected to be completed next year, sets the first national limits on carbon dioxide, the chief gas linked to climate change. While environmental groups laud the initiatives, many business groups and opposition legislators argue that such actions will cost jobs, increase the cost of power, and inflict severe harm on the economy. The changes will further diminish the role of coal in U.S. electrical production. Power plants are the largest source of greenhouse gases in the United States, accounting for about a third of the country's annual emissions. Well, with us to discuss the pros and cons of the plan to cut carbon emissions, we turn to two analysts. Kevin Kennedy is director of the U.S. Climate Initiative at the World Resources Institute. He oversees the Institute's climate and energy strategy in the United States, working with federal agencies, Congress, state governments, businesses, and other stakeholders to advance a clean energy economy and respond to climate change. And Nick Loris. He's an economist and senior policy analyst focusing on energy, environmental, and regulatory issues at the Heritage Foundation. That's a conservative think tank here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, Kevin Kennedy with the World Resources Institute, let me begin with you to get your overall reaction to this plan to cut carbon emissions from power plants in the United States by nearly one-third over the next 15 years.
We're extremely pleased by the plan that EPA has announced. The plan is the first time that we're putting limits on carbon pollution from power plants. And as we're increasingly already seeing the impacts from climate change in communities around the country, it's definitely time to put sensible limits in place on this type of pollution.
Nick Loris, for a quick reaction, your perspective on this plan.
Yeah, we're opposed to this regulation. You know, we feel that by implementing these regulations, not to mention the regulations on new power plants, the greenhouse gas emission limits on new power plants that will effectively ban the construction of coal-fired power plants, we feel this plan is a massive energy tax that'll reverberate through the economy, affecting families and businesses, and it will be devoid of any meaningful climate benefit.
Back to you, Kevin Kennedy. How do you answer critics like Nick Loris and others who are concerned that this measure will hurt the economy, cost jobs, increase costs of power, and so forth?
The plan that the EPA has put forward is really a very flexible plan that allows individual states to tailor the particulars of what they do to their particular needs and their particular resource base. And the sort of flexibility that they're looking at really taps into things that have already been happening in the U.S. to some degree, where low-cost natural gas has allowed some degree of switching from coal power to natural gas, lowering emissions. Where increasingly low cost of renewable power that is coming into the system. You have state policies encouraging renewable power. You have state policies already encouraging energy efficiency. EPA's plan essentially taps those building blocks to allow states to construct something that can be very cost effective for their states and still achieve meaningful reductions.
Well, Nick Lawrence, what about those arguments that states are already implementing some of these other energy sources, alternatives to coal-fired plants, natural gas, renewable energy, etc.?
Yeah, we'd like to see that. You know, at Heritage, we're not pro any energy source. And I think there's this notion that the conservative movement is pro oil, gas, and nuclear and anti everything else. And that's not the case. You know, we want to see a free market energy economy to provide the most affordable and reliable energy sources. And if that's more renewables, you know, that's great. But we don't want to see any energy source unnecessarily driven out through burdensome regulations that, again, don't have any meaningful environmental benefit. And I think that's what you're seeing here with these regulations. And it's certainly going to drive up the cost of energy, not drive it down.
Well, Kevin Kennedy, do you see these regulations as burdensome? I mean, how can they be construed as burdensome and also address this question of driving costs higher?
Well, first, the electricity system in this country has been designed for many years to deal with a variety of constraints, economic constraints, transmission constraints, and pollution constraints that are placed on the power plants that supply electricity. What's been missing from the system up to this point are any constraints on the carbon pollution that particularly coal and to some degree natural gas put into the atmosphere. And so this is a way of bringing that particular constraint into the picture and making sure that all of the energy sources that are supplying electricity not only are coming in at the reasonable cost that they can, but that they're acknowledging the cost that they're putting on the environment. And these rules will really be able to help do that and really make sure that coal power doesn't get a free ride in terms of the carbon pollution that it's been putting into the atmosphere.
Well, Nick Lawrence, this carbon pollution that coal-fired plants are responsible for in large part, that is an important concern, wouldn't you agree? And something has to be done at some point to curb those emissions that pollute our air.
Yeah, I think things need to be done. Regulations need to be put in place for coal-fired power plants and natural gas power plants and really any energy source that pollutes our air. Where I think the fundamental disagreement is whether carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas regulations are a pollutant. Now, the Environmental Protection Agency certainly says that they are, but I think if you look at the climate realities and if you look at the data, the fact is, yes, we are heading towards a warmer planet. Yes, man-made greenhouse gas emissions are certainly playing a role in that, but I don't think we're headed towards this catastrophic climate change that the administration purports we're heading towards. And even if we were, again, these regulations wouldn't do anything to mitigate global temperatures.
Now, you say the administration, but there's a global consensus that we're going toward global warming, which is very threatening to the planet.
Certainly, there's a concern about that. But if you look at even the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, if you look at data from NOAA, these things don't say we're headed towards that catastrophic climate change. They don't say anything about heading towards more frequent and intense natural disasters. Again, the climate is changing. The climate is warming. I think whether or not it's headed towards catastrophic warming is something we need to have an open and honest discussion about. And if we are, we need to have the policies in place to be able to adapt to that climate change, not necessarily regulate our way out of it, because again, I don't think these regulations, even if we are headed towards catastrophic climate change, are going to make a difference.
Well, back to you, Kevin Kennedy. We have a disagreement, obviously, on that point, but there are also other benefits, health benefits, presumably, to this plan, and also the possibility of spurring renewable energy sources, solar, wind, and of course, natural gas. Talk about the health benefits that you see and that the EPA administrator has talked about, as well as the possibility of trying to ramp up these renewable sources.
Yes, and certainly it's the case that these rules will help reduce the emissions, not just of carbon dioxide, but of sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxides that are a very important part of other types of pollution, will help reduce mercury pollution. If you look at the overall public health impacts, those are very significant, that you're looking at more than 100,000 reduced asthma cases in children by the time the rules are fully implemented, that you're seeing very significant sort of public health benefits that aren't the purpose of the rule, but definitely come from the changes in the electricity system that would be instituted. And the increased investment in energy efficiency and renewables will also provide some very important benefits in local communities around the country, where there's opportunities to really invest much more in those sources as well.
Nick Lawrence, what about those arguments that, again, not that the health benefits were the aim of this policy per se, but certainly there will be savings in that regard, better health for Americans, therefore fewer costs, hospital costs, and other health costs. And of course, the importance of alternative energy sources, cleaner energy sources, isn't that a positive thing?
Well, I think you need to look at the co-benefits and the fact that we already have regulations to reduce sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide, to reduce any type of ozone pollutants as well. And then again, you need to look at the cost-benefit analysis of these rules. For instance, the Environmental Protection Agency recently put in place mercury rules that would have, what the EPA said, an estimated $10 billion in annual benefits, but only 7 million of those benefits came from an actual reduction in mercury. That basically 99.996% came from these co-benefits. So yes, we should have regulations on things that have direct adverse health impacts, but we shouldn't overestimate the health impacts from regulations that won't have the desired environmental effects that are intended by the administration.
And what about the spurring of the renewable energy sources that this policy could precipitate?
Well, you know, I'd love to see more renewable sources, you know, compete. I think we certainly need to remove energy subsidies for all energy sources, including those for oil and natural gas and nuclear, and create a competitive environment for renewables. But I don't think, again, it should be done through over heavily regulation that unnecessarily drives affordable, reliable energy out. You know, I still think that even if these regulations are put in place, I believe that a lot of what's going to be made up in terms of lost coal is going to be natural gas, because natural gas is cleaner and it is certainly abundant throughout the United States. So I'm not sure how much renewables will grow absent all of these policies that subsidize renewables, as well as these, you know, mandates throughout the states that a certain percent of our electricity come from renewables. Those are the policies I'd like to see us get away from and create a more competitive environment for renewables to thrive in the marketplace.
Any reaction to that?
Well,
Kevin?
And one of the issues that has been facing renewables and other sources is that the fossil fuel portion of the electricity system has been very well entrenched. And so with all new energy sources, it's often necessary to have some degree of incentives in the early stages of adoption. And what we're starting to see is some real benefits in terms of significant cost reductions in what it takes to put new renewables on the grid that are paying off in terms of the investments that have been put into incentives in those sources. And so as you look over time, you may be able to move away from those incentives, but in the early stages, they make a lot of sense.
Now, with respect to natural gas, does that disturb people in your camp, that those who are very much in favor of these types of measures, because it is a fossil fuel, that it will gain as a result of the measures taken to reduce carbon emissions from coal-powered plants?
There's certainly some degree of concern along those lines. But as we look at it, we see if you need to get very quick emission reductions, natural gas is going to be very much a part of that equation, particularly since there are many natural gas power plants that have been built over the last decade or so that are not being used as much as they could. So the infrastructure is already in place in many places to increase natural gas use and decrease coal use and get very near-term benefits. We saw that to an extreme degree a couple years ago when the price of natural gas dropped to about $2. And you saw natural gas almost catch up to coal in terms of the electricity mix in this country. Today, the price is back up a bit, so you've seen coal recover a bit. And that's part of why these sorts of rules are needed in order to send a long-term market signal that the higher carbon sources are going to not be able to simply be a continuing part of the mix without some degree of controls and limits.
And a quick response from you, Nick Loris.
Yeah, well, I think a diverse, competitive energy economy ultimately benefits consumers and businesses, and that's a good thing. But, you know, the fact is wind has been getting this production tax credit that is a direct subsidy for their industry, off and on a little bit, but basically since 1982. So it's not that it's something that's relatively new. And I think we hear this argument from industries, whether it's renewable or not, that, oh, we only need 5 years of subsidies and then you can phase them out or get rid of them. And then once that fifth year is up, they send all their lobbyists to Washington, D.C. to lobby for a 5-year extension. And that's true, again, regardless of industry. And we see this nature of really Washington policymakers and lobbyists making these decisions rather than the free market.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Kevin Kennedy. He's director of the U.S. Climate Initiative at the World Resources Institute here in Washington, and Nick Lawrence. He's an economist and senior policy analyst focusing on energy, environmental, and regulatory issues at the Heritage Foundation. We're talking about the politics and substance of President Obama's proposal to cut carbon emissions from power plants in the United States by nearly one-third in the next 15 years. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. And please don't be a stranger. Send us an email with your feedback to encounter@voanews.com. Tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Well, back to you, Kevin Kennedy. Let's get more into this plan, its implementation, some of the impediments to it. As Nick Lawrence implied, there's going to be some pushback on this, perhaps litigation. There's also politics. There are Democrats who normally would side with President Obama who are in coal states, who are a bit skittish about this plan, and we're in an election year. So senators in states like Louisiana, Arkansas, Alaska, they're on the front lines of battle for Senate seats. So talk about these, you know, impediments and politics.
Yes. First, I should say that we're a nonprofit research organization and not a political organization, so I won't get too much into the elections this November. The overall politics of the issue for a very long time had actually more to do with coal states versus non-coal states than it did Democrats versus Republicans. And more recently, you've seen much more of a partisan split. And in some ways, it's almost progress to be getting back to the coal versus non-coal states, where the question really is, how do you distribute the costs and the benefits of addressing climate change, rather than a more ideological split on whether or not climate change is real? So one of the things that the EPA knew that they had to do for this rule to work, because this part of the Clean Air Act in particular is very much a federal-state partnership. EPA sets the standards for the states, but it really are the 50 individual states that will be putting the specific plans in place to say how those targets will be implemented. So EPA took a lot of time and effort to go and talk to the states, to talk to the utilities, to talk to business groups, to environmental groups, to understand what the concerns were from all sides, and really tried to craft a rule that provided the flexibility for each individual state to be able to meet its own needs in terms of how it would address this, and also set the proposed standards in a way that recognized that some states have a lot of hydropower and therefore a lot of zero carbon energy available. Other states are currently very dependent on coal. So as you look at what's expected of the different states, they've provided that sort of differentiation, that the states that are very coal dependent, they recognize that in setting the standard. And states that have more low hydropower and similar resources have much more stringent standards to face. So some of it is really just taking into account the starting place for the states. And then the flexibility comes in by identifying a number of key building blocks. Natural gas as a potential source in place of coal, improving the efficiency of coal plants, increased renewables, increased efficiency, and taking those into account as well, and basically saying, we'll set the standards based on those factors. And then states, you can pick and choose what's going to work for you when you put your plans together.
Turning back to you, Nick Lawrence, in addition to politics, and I know we're not going to get into that, but that certainly is a factor we need to be cognizant about. What about the litigation? Are organizations like yours and others who are not very keen on this plan, do you see lots of litigation to try to slow down the implementation? What are we looking at?
I do, and not with just this regulation, but also the regulation for new power plants that, again, would effectively ban new coal-fired power plants, and that litigation is already being teed up because what the EPA calls the best available technology in carbon capture and sequestration is really quite a pipe dream right now in terms of cost and just actual implementation across the country. So I think there's going to be a lot of state interest to challenge these regulations. I think there's going to be members of Congress who want to prohibit the Environmental Protection Agency and other agencies from regulating greenhouse gas emissions because, you know, if you go back to 2008 when then candidate Obama said that under his cap and trade plan, which is this is, I would say, the regulatory equivalent, essentially. He said under his cap-and-trade plan, electricity rates would necessarily skyrocket. And when the House passed that cap-and-trade plan, you know, they heard an earful that this was a massive energy tax, and it really kind of killed cap-and-trade on the spot. So I think you're going to hear a lot of legislators and a lot of state attorney generals really weigh in on this and try and prevent it.
Back to you, Kevin Kennedy, before we close and talk about the global implications. A quick reaction on this litigation. How much of an impediment will that be, in your view, to getting this plan underway?
There certainly will be lawsuits filed. And I think what's clear, though, is that the EPA has a lot of legal authority to act in the way that it has under the Clean Air Act. The Supreme Court has clearly supported that carbon dioxide is a pollutant in the terms of the Clean Air Act, and therefore EPA is obligated to act on this pollutant once it found, as it did, that it endangers public health and the environment. These courts, and very recently the Supreme Court, have also tended to defer to the judgment of an agency when trying to implement these type of complicated pieces of legislation. For the most recent case the Supreme Court heard had to do with what in some ways was a similar rule called the cross-state air pollution rule that EPA had put in place. And the Supreme Court found that EPA was right to use its judgment in terms of how to judge the costs and benefits. I think in many ways, it's not a direct corollary to this case, but the types of flexibility that EPA is talking about is exactly the sort of approach that they were using in that other case that the Supreme Court found in their favor.
Well, to conclude, back to you, Kevin Kennedy, let's talk about the global reaction. Certainly, it's been relatively positive, at least the press that I've read. And many think that the United States' push to cut carbon emissions is partly intended not just for domestic benefit, but also to spur other large emitters like China to cut their emissions more aggressively to tackle climate change. Do you think that the United States can bring other nations to the table?
I think this action and the climate action plan that the president announced last year that this is part of, the continued implementation of that by the administration, shows the world that the United States is serious about acting on carbon pollution. And it's true that this rule by itself will not cut global carbon emissions by a significant amount, but it's the fact that the United States is taking serious action to cut carbon pollution in the electricity sector, previously from cars, and looking across the economy, that provides reassurance to countries like China and Europe and others that are trying to decide where they're going to go over the next 10 to 15 years. China's taking a lot of action to invest in clean energy, partly for air pollution reasons, partly for climate reasons. But getting China and the rest of the world to agree to a strong international agreement, which without question is needed to address climate change, it's going to require the United States to be a serious part of that discussion. And this step helps the United States demonstrate that seriousness.
Nick Lauris, how do you see this move as a potential spur to other countries, large carbon emitters such as China? Do you think this can serve as an important example?
I don't. I think, you know, the administration has really said that if we lead, the rest will follow. I think we're going to turn around and see that nobody's behind us on these regulations. One, because these developing countries, you know, you slap that word developing in front of them for a reason, is that they're still developing. They're building about a coal plant a week to get affordable and reliable electricity to their citizens. And they have more pressing environmental concerns to deal with, like gaining access to breathable air and clean drinking water, neither of which have anything to do with regulating greenhouse gas emissions. So they certainly need pollution control. But if you see, China will install these scrubbers and then not even turn them on because they want the cheap electricity. So you're starting to see some investments because the air has gotten so bad there. But again, that doesn't have anything to do with carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas emissions. That has to do with the black carbon and the soot that's coming out of these power plants. Not to mention, if we implement these regulations, you could see a lot of businesses go from the United States to these unregulated economies in India and China, where the business climate is a lot friendlier, where they don't have these regulations, and ultimately make the problem worse.
Kevin Kennedy, how do you react to that? The developing countries, of course, China is a huge economy, but others, India and others, may see greater benefit in just pursuing their economic interests and not worrying so much about environmental costs. What are your thoughts?
I think you're increasingly seeing these countries recognizing that part of their economic interest in the long term is dealing with climate change. And certainly there are very pressing near-term concerns that have been driving growth in emissions in those countries as you get the necessary increased access to energy. But part of what those countries are also looking at are questions about how do you actually increase access to clean energy, not just the cheapest energy, because the sort of environmental problems that you're looking at, whether it's the local air pollution or the global climate change in the longer term, are things that their people are going to need to deal with. So I think you're starting to see change, and it's not that the United States is in front of everybody else. In some ways, the United States is trying to catch up to many other countries, but having the United States as a serious part of the discussion is going to be an extreme help.
Well, the last word to you, Nick Lawrence. Certainly the European Union has been waiting for the United States to sort of take the lead or do something more serious, such as perhaps this plan, even though it's modest in a sense. But the last word to you on this plan and its global implications.
Well, again, we see this plan as a massive energy tax devoid of any climate benefit. And I think there's pro-growth ways to drive jobs, drive wealth, both here and internationally, that don't necessitate regulation. Free trade, the ability to hydraulically frack in China and other places could be a real game changer in getting places away from coal. Freely trading our clean energy technologies, I think, is a huge benefit to the developing world. So, you know, I think there's pro-growth policies that we can take that can not only drive down emissions, but also help grow the economy both here and abroad.
All right. Well, we know that the first test of U.S. influence on global climate policy could come in Paris in 2015 when representatives from governments around the world meet to talk about a new global pact aimed at extending emission reduction targets beyond 2020. But for now, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Kevin Kennedy. He's director of the U.S. Climate Initiative at the World Resources Institute here in Washington, and Nick Lawrence. He's economist and senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Gentlemen, thanks so much for coming in, sharing your insights.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Vasco Volorić. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.